Chapter 36. The small object in his hand without being able to steady his confused ideas. Gradually they took shape, and he saw that, if the ornament had fallen from the harness of the traveler who had just preceded them, it was not Fulvia, but he himself who was being pursued. But who was it who sought him, and to what purpose? One fact alone was clear. The traveler, whoever he was, rode in one of the Duke's carriages, and therefore presumably upon his sovereign's business. Odo was still trying to thread a way through these conjectures, when a yawning ostler pushed open the stable door. "Your Excellency is in a hurry to be gone," he said, with a surprised glance. Odo handed him the coat of arms. "See, can you tell me what this is?" he asked carelessly. I picked it up here a moment ago." The other turned it over and stared. "W.Y.," said he, "that's off the harness of the gentleman that supped here last night, the same that went on later to Peshiera." Odo proceeded to question him about the mule tracks over Monte Baldo, and having bidden him saddle the horses in half an hour, crossed the courtyard and re-entered the inn. A gray light was already falling through the windows, and he mounted the stairs and knocked on the door which he thought must be Fulvia's. Her voice bade him enter, and he found her seated fully dressed beside the window. She rose with a smile, and he saw that as he had regained her usual self-possession. "Do we set out at once?" she asked. "There is no great haste," he answered. "Why, you must eat first, and by that time the horses will be saddled." "As you please," she returned, with a readiness in which he divined the wish to make amends for her willfulness the previous night. Her eyes and cheeks glowed with an excitement which counterfeited the effects of a night's rest, and he thought he had never seen her more radiant. She approached the table on which the wine and bread had been placed, and drew another chair beside her own. "Will you not share with me?" she asked, filling a glass for him. He took it from her with a smile. I have good news for you," he said, holding out the bit of silver which he had brought from the stable. She examined it wonderingly. "W, what does this mean?" she asked, looking up at him. "That it is I who am being followed and not you." She started and the ornament slipped from her hand. "You?" she faltered with a quick change of color. "This coat of arms," he explained, "dropped from the harness of the traveler who left the inn just before our arrival last night." "Well," she said, still without understanding, "and do you know the coat?" Odo smiled. It is mine," he answered, "and the crown is my cousin's. The traveler must have been a messenger of the Duke's." She stood leaning against the seat from which as he had risen, one hand still grasping it, while the other hung inert. Her lips parted, but she did not speak. Her pallor troubled Odo and he went up to her, and took her hand. "Do you not understand," he said gently, "that there is no farther cause for alarm? I have no reason to think that the Duke's messenger is in pursuit of me, but should he be so, and should he overtake us, he has no authority over you, and no reason for betraying you to your enemies." The blood poured back to her face. "Me? My enemies?" she stammered. "It is not of them I think." She raised her head, and faced him in a glow. For a moment he stood stupidly gazing at her, then the mist lifted, and through it, he saw a great light. The landlord's knock warned them that their horses waited, and they rode out in the gray morning. The world about them still lay in shade, and as they climbed the wooded defile above the valley, Odo was reminded of the days at Donis, when he had ridden up the mountain in the same early light. Never since then had he felt, as he did now, the boy's easy kinship with the unexpected, the sense that no encounter could be too wonderful, to fit in with the mere wonder of living. To avoid the road to Peshiera, they had resolved to cross the Monte Baldo by a mule track which should bring them out at one of the villages on the eastern shore of Garda. And the search for this path led them up through steep rain-scented woods, where they had to part the wet boughs as they passed. From time to time they regained the highway and rode abreast, almost silent at first with the weight of their new nearness, and then breaking into talk that was the mere overflow of what they were thinking. There was in truth more to be felt between them than to be said, since, as each was aware, the new light that suffused the present left the future as obscure as before. But what mattered, when the hour was theirs? The narrow kingdom of today is better worth ruling over than the widest past or future, but not more than once does a man hold its fugitive scepter. The past, however, was theirs also. A past so transformed, that he must revisit it with her, joyously confronting her new self with the image of her that met them at each turn. Then he had himself to trace in her memories, his transfigured likeness to linger over in the Narcissus mirror of her faith in him. This interchange of recollection served them as well as any outspoken expression of feeling, and the most commonplace allusion was charged with happy meanings. Arabia Petria had been an Eden to such travelers. How much more the happy slopes they were now descending! All the afternoon their path wound down the western incline of Monte Baldo, first under huge olives, then through thickets of laurel and acacia, to emerge on a lower level of lemon and orange groves, with the blue lake showing through a diaper of golden fruited boughs. Fulvia, to whom this clear-cut southern foliage was as new as the pure intensity of light that bathed it, seemed to herself to be moving through the landscape of a dream. It was as though nature had been remodeled, transformed almost, under the touch of their love. As though they had found their way to the Hesperian glades in which poets and painters placed the legendary lovers of antiquity. Such feelings were intensified by the strangeness of the situation. In Italy, the young girls of the middle class, though seemingly allowed a greater freedom of intercourse than the daughters of noblemen, were in reality as strictly guarded. Though, like Fulvia, they might converse with the elderly merchants, or scholars frequenting the family table, they were never alone in the company of men, and the high standard of conduct prevailing in the bourgeoisie forbade all thought of clandestine intercourse. This was especially true of the families of men of letters, where the liberal education of the young girls, and their habit of associating as equals with men of serious and cultivated minds, gave them a self-possession disconcerting to the young blood accustomed to conquer with a glance. These girls, as a rule, were married early to men of their own standing, and though the Cicisbeo was not unknown after marriage, he was not an authorized member of the household. Fulvia, indeed, belonged to the class most inaccessible to men of Odo's rank, the only class in Italy in which the wife's fidelity was as much esteemed as the innocence of the girl. Such principles had long been ridiculed by persons of quality, and satirized by poets and playwrights. From Aristophanes to Bimarchus, the cheated husband, and the outwitted guardian had been the figures on which the dramatist relied for his comic effects. Even the miser tricked out of his savings was a shade less ridiculous, less grotesquely deserving of his fate, than the husband defrauded of his wife's affection. The plausible adulteress and the adroit seducer had a recognized claim on the sympathy of the public. But the inevitable reaction was at hand, and the new teachers to whom Odo's contemporaries were beginning to listen had thrown a strangely poetic light over the dull figures of the domestic virtues. Faithfulness to the family sanctities, reverence for the marriage tie, courage to sacrifice the loftiest passion to the most plodding duty. These were qualities to touch the fancy of a generation sated with derision. If love as a sentiment was the discovery of the medieval poets, love as a moral emotion might be called that of the 18th century philosophers, who, for all their celebration of free unions and fatal passions, were really on the side of the angels, were fighting the battle of the spiritual against the sensual, of conscience against appetite. The imperceptible action of these new influences formed the real barrier between Odo and Fulvia. The girl stood for the embodiment of the purifying emotions that were to renew the world. Her candor, her unapproachableness, her simple trust in him, were a part of the magic light which the new idealism had shed over the old social structure. His was, in short, a love large enough to include other emotions. A widening rather than a contraction of the emotional range. Youth and propinquity have before now broken down stronger defenses, but Fulvia's situation was an unspoken appeal to her lover's forbearance. The sense that her safety depended on him kept his sentimental impulses in check, and made the happiness of the moment seem, in its exquisite unreality, a mere dreamlike interlude between the facts of life. Toward sunset they rested in an olive orchard, tethering their horses to the low boughs. Overhead, through the thin foliage of tarnished silver, the sky, as the moon suffused it, melted from steel blue to a clearer silver. A peasant woman whose hut stood close by brought them a goat's cheese on a vine leaf, and a jug of spring water, and as they supped, a little goat herd, driving his flock down the hill, paused to watch them with furtive woodland eyes. Odo, questioning him, learned that at the village on the shore below they could obtain a boat to carry them across the lake. Fulvia, for lack of a passport, dared not set foot on Austrian soil, but the Swiss authorities were less exacting, and Odo had hopes of crossing the border without difficulty. They set out again presently, descending through the gray dusk of the olives till the path became too steep for riding. Then Odo lifted Fulvia from the saddle, and led the two horses after her. Here and there, between the trees, they caught a momentary glimpse of lights on the shore, and the pale gleam of the lake enclosed in black foliage. From the village below came snatches of song, and the shrill wail of a pipe, and as the night deepened they saw, far out on the water, the wild flare of the fish spears' torches, like comets in an inverted sky. With nightfall the spirits of both had sunk. Fulvia walked ahead in silence and Odo read a mute apprehension in her drooping outline. Every step brought them nearer to the point they both feared to face, and though each knew what lay in the other's thoughts neither dared break the silence. Odo's mind turned anxiously to the incidents of the morning, to the finding of the ducal coat of arms, and to all the possibilities it suggested. What errand save one could have carried an envoy from Pianura to that remote hamlet among the hills? He could scarcely doubt that it was in pursuit of himself that the ducal messenger traveled, but with what object was the journey undertaken? Was he to be recalled in obedience to some new whim of the duke's? Or at some unforeseen change he dared not let his thoughts define that suddenly made his presence needful in Pianura? It was more probable that the possibility of his flight with Fulvia had been suggested to the duke by the ecclesiastical authorities, and that the same hand which had parted them before was again secretly at work. In any case, it was Odo's first business to see his companion safely across the border, and in that endeavor he had now little fear of being thwarted. If the duke's messenger awaited them at Peschiera, he waited in vain. And though their flight across the lake might be known before dawn, it would then be no easy matter to overtake them. In an hour's time, as Odo had hoped, they were putting off from the shore in a blunt-nosed fishing boat which was the lightest craft the village could provide. The lake was stark calm, and the two boatmen, silhouetted against the moonlight, drove the boat forward with even vigorous strokes. Fulvia, shivering in the autumnal chill, had drawn her hood close about her and sat silent, her face in shade. Measured by their secret apprehensions, the boat's progress seemed at first indescribably slow, but gradually the sounds from the shore grew fainter, and the fugitives felt themselves alone in a world enclosed by the moonlit circle of the waters. As they advanced, this sense of isolation and security grew deeper and more impressive. The motionless surface of the lake was enclosed in a wall of mountains which the moonlight seemed to vein with marble. A sky in which the stars were dissolved in white radiance curved high above their heads, and not a sail flecked the lake or a cloud the sky. The boat seemed suspended alone in some ethereal medium. Presently one of the boatmen spoke to the other and glanced toward the north. Then the second silently shipped his oar and hoisted the sail. Hardly had he made it fast, when a fresh of wind came down the lake and they began to stretch across the bay with spreading canvas. The wind was contrary, but Odo welcomed it, for he saw at once that it would be quicker work to tack to the other shore than to depend on the oars. The scene underwent a sudden change. The silver mirror over which they had appeared to glide was shivered in two sparkling fragments, and in the enveloping rush and murmur of the night the boat woke to a creaking, straining activity. The man at the rudder suddenly pointed to a huddle of lights to the south. "Peepashira." Odo laughed. "W, we shall soon show it our heels," said he. The other boatman shrugged his shoulders. "Even an enemy's roof may serve to keep out the storm," he observed philosophically. "The storm? What storm?" The man pointed to the north. Against the sky hung a little black cloud, the merest flaw in the perfect curve of the night. "The lake is shrewish at this season," the boatman continued. "Did your excellencies burn a candle before starting?" Odo sat silent, his eyes fixed on the cloud. It was growing visibly now. With every moment its outline seemed to shift and spread, till its black menace dilated to the zenith. The bright water still broke about them in diamond spray, but as the shadow traveled the lake beneath it turned to lead. Then the storm dropped on them. It fell suddenly out of mid-heaven. Sky and water grew black, and a long shudder ran through the boat. For a moment she hung back, staggering under a white fury of blows. Then the gale seemed to lift and swing her about, and she shot forward through a long tunnel of glistening blackness. "Bows on for Peshira." "The enemy's roof," thought Odo. He reached for Fulvia's hand and found it in the darkness. The rain was driving against them now, and he drew her close and wrapped his cloak about her. She lay still, without a tremor, as though in that shelter no fears could reach her. The night roared about them, and the water seemed to divide beneath their keel. Through the tumult Odo shouted to the boatmen to try to make some harbor north of Peshira. They shouted back that they must go where the wind willed, and bless the saints, if they made any harbor at all, and Odo saw that Peshira was their destiny. It was past midnight when they set foot on shore. The rain still fell in torrents, and they could hardly grope their way up the steps of the landing stage. Odo's first concern was to avoid the inn, but the boatmen, exhausted by their efforts and impatient to be under shelter, could not be bribed to seek out at that hour another lodging for the travelers. Odo dared not expose Fulvia longer to the storm, and reluctantly they turned toward the inn, trusting that at that hour their coming would attract little notice. A traveling carriage stood in the courtyard, and somewhat to Odo's surprise the landlord was still afoot. He led them into the public parlor, which was alight, with a good fire on the hearth. A gentleman in traveling dress sat near this fire, his back to the door, reading by a shaded candle. He rose as the travelers entered, and Odo recognized the abate de Crucis. The latter advanced with a smile in which pleasure was more visible than surprise. He bowed slightly to Fulvia, who had shrunk back into the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.